We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Recently, I've been pretty busy with work and, you know, competitions coming up and things like that. So I'm filled with stress. And as a good Russian, when I'm filled with stress, I complain to people about being so stressed. But because of a book you recommended recently, Anti-Fragile by Nassim Nicholas Taleb, maybe I shouldn't be complaining so much about being stressed. In fact, when I'm not stressed, I should be complaining about having a way too good of a life, because it seems that we're creatures that improve or grow from stress, from being an uncomfortable, having to deal with uncomfortable situations, from having to deal with stuff you haven't encountered before, chaos, randomness, things like that.
Yeah, he makes a pretty good distinction, too, between, like, different types of stress that are beneficial. Like, you know, the difference between chronic stress, which breaks you down over time, and, you know, that's what puts you in the hospital eventually. Or, you know, like when you do jiu-jitsu 7 days a week, training hard, and your body breaks down, instead of, like, you know, having, like, acute stresses, you know, fairly regularly, but not so much that you're burning yourself out. I think that's what you grow from.
There's like this breaking point he's talking about, right? That you grow stronger as long as the stress is not above that breaking point.
Yeah.
And I think like a lot of these types of books, right? He talks about a concept that's been around forever. But the cool thing about it is he does kind of put a word on it. And he does highlight the fact that there is no word for the opposite of fragile. A lot of times we think that the opposite of fragile is
like robust,
yeah. So like the opposite of fragile is something that like benefits from being shaken up and damaged.
Yeah, like people always use the example of the cockroach for something that's resilient. You know, like a cockroach could survive like a nuclear war, it can survive getting stepped on, it can survive bug spray, but it doesn't actually get better from those stressors. Like you can't spray a cockroach with bug spray and it turns into like a super cockroach, you know?
That's the stuff for nightmares right there.
Yeah.
By the way, you guys have cockroaches over there?
No, actually,
in the north?
No, they don't come to our side of the tracks. They know better.
Yeah, there's big ones here in Philly.
We have spiders though. We have a lot of spiders in my backyard and assorted bugs, but cockroaches are pretty good with.
Are you so you're a married man, would you say you have more or less fear of spiders than Angie, your wife?
Originally I had a lot more fear of spiders because I always grew up kind of arachnophobic, I guess. But since we have a lot of spiders in the house, I've made attempts to try and become friends with them, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, I'm one of those guys, it sounds stupid, I'm one of those guys that, like, I find a bug in the house and I take it outside and try and rehabilitate it instead of, like, you know, crushing it and freaking out. So, like, with something like a spider where I would usually scream in terror and run, we have so many of them in the house that I just have to, like, I either got to deal with it or I have to learn to like them. I guess it's an anti-fragile thing, you know? Like,
yeah.
I got these spiders, I got to deal with it, so instead of hating them and being scared, I try to, like, you know, I don't pet them or anything like that, but I try to, like, get close and get over my fear of them.
Yeah, no, I've never been able to be anti-fragile about the cockroach issue. I am quite violent and very stressed about the bug situation. Whenever they appear, I have, even if I do kill the cockroach, I live in fear for days afterwards because I know there's probably more of them where that cockroach came from. So,
yeah, planning to get you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting, you know, it sounds silly, but it's a pretty interesting discussion, this kind of thing, like killing bugs and what you do with them. Like, I always, you know, growing up, I would just, like, step on a bug and swat a fly and never had any problems with it. And then I started thinking, you know, well, if I was a bug and I was just hanging out, eating some, sitting in somebody's tomatoes, and somebody came and squished me or sprayed some bullshit on my head, I'd be pretty upset. So I stopped messing with them. But not, you know, I mean, I don't, my wife doesn't think like that. She's the opposite way. Like, if she sees a bug, then she's like the Predator in that movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
Like, she spots them. She can see them from 2 miles away, and she's a killer.
And you're both not vegetarian, right?
No, we eat a lot of meat.
Yeah, so it's not a matter of, like, you have a fundamental respect for life or something.
I mean, I have a respect for life. It's just like, I don't know. It's silly. It's like one of those things where, you know, people listening right now are probably like, you know, thinking like, oh, you take a bug outside, but you eat a steak. It's the same thing. Like, you know, it is the same thing. I'm an idiot. I mean, I realize this about myself.
Yeah, we live a contradiction in so many ways. Yeah. One of the interesting things is, now I just started reading this book, so I didn't get all the way through, but it does seem to suggest about, you know, different approaches to, like, diet, for example. At least it makes me think of the, you know, throw in a wrench into the whole thing every once in a while, you know, kind of like a cheat day or whatever. You don't want to even do a regular cheat day. You really want to constantly throw in random stressors as opposed to, quote, periodic stressors. So, like, you basically want to constantly put yourself into situations that are full of uncertainty. You know, not like in a schedule, not like on a Saturday afternoon, I'm going to, play a guard in jiu-jitsu that I haven't played before. No, right. just embrace weird things, you know. Maybe start conversations with weird people, or just hit somebody in the face on the street as you're walking, and see where that goes from there. Or like maybe hug a bus driver, you know, for a little too long. just get crazy with it. I actually don't exactly know what, you know, the practical implications of what he suggests, but I do like the idea that we shouldn't run from this uncertainty of life. We should kind of embrace it and grow from it.
Yeah, it seems like a really opportunistic philosophy. Like, it's like my cats. Like, they eat dry food pretty much every single day, but if I accidentally drop some lunch meat on the floor, they're after it. Quick. They're like, you know, they see that random event and they're always ready. Like, doesn't matter where in the house I am, if I drop even the small scrap of, like, honey ham on the ground, they're there. You know? They're ready.
Yeah, so they're that's the thing. That's the way of life. That's what, like, that's how evolution works. That's everything on this planet except us silly human beings completely embrace the uncertainty and adjust. The very mechanism of evolution is anti-fragile. Like, the change itself is what produces growth. We went from fish to mammals to whatever the hell we are through that very process of just the environment testing us. So your cats are just like this million of years of evolution.
Yep, they spent millions of years evolving just so they could snatch up some scraps of mesquite flavored jerky breast that I drop.
It's kind of a fascinating idea that there's all that history. There's like, they're perfect. They're like designed for that. They were designed to live under this great monarch, Josh Vogel. Who produces tasty snacks every once in a while, and to hunt those snacks down.
Yep. Random lunch meats and tuna juice.
and also, like, just one as a kind of tangent of that, there's a statement that caught my eye that I really like, that he says to not follow any theories. So, you know, like, with dieting, with working out, with training, there's a lot of theories out there of, like, You know, here, for, if you follow this system, you will lose X amount of pounds, or you know, if you follow this system, you will be a world champion. The idea that there is any one system that will get you somewhere is a faulty one, that you need to constantly adjust based on your own experience and based on the constantly changing conditions of your own experience. So, you know, do the stuff that has worked in the past, and the moment that stuff stops working, you explore to try to find stuff that works better.
Yeah, and he brings up a good point about that when he talks about heuristics, like simple rules of thumb to follow. Like,
yes,
kind of like in jiu-jitsu, like you have the rule of thumb that generally when you're in somebody's closed guard, you want to posture up, and generally you want to try and, I mean, at least in modern jiu-jitsu, it's sort of accepted that most people stand and break the guard open, and that's the way to do it. And, you know, but there's, you can't say that, like, the way that I stand and break a guard open is going to be the way that, you know, like our instructor Rick is going to stand and break the guard open because of different body types, you know. Right. But the general heuristic is that, you know, okay, you got to posture up, you got to stand, and then from there, the little details are kind of your own, you know, what you need to do. I think his point is that in any really complex system, it's hard to have a very specific game plan for every eventuality because it gets too complex too quickly.
Right. You know, don't try to predict, you know, that's the other of his books, Black Swans. Don't try to predict these rare events that are going to, you know, really offset what you expected, but just live in the fact that those events will happen. Shit that you didn't think would happen will happen, and embrace that. Embrace that fact and, you know, go with the flow, as cheesy as that sounds. You know, as jiu-jitsu guys, nothing really embodies that more than competing. You know, when I go to training, I basically go through the same motions in terms of, you know, you show up, you know, opening the door, going up the stairs, you know, changing, you go, you know, you take the class, you do the drilling, and then you get your, whatever, 8 to 10 rounds of training in, and you go home happy, and you repeat or do some laundry, whatever. There's a habit, there's a regularity, and that's actually what, you know, a lot of people enjoy. It's a good part of your everyday life. But I think competing is the opposite of that. I mean, what you encounter when you step on the mat is there's all these different dudes, or at least at my rank level of purple belt, because the divisions are pretty big. There's a lot of new characters all the time. Like, you know, there's fat, short guys. There's tall, skinny guys. There's weird dudes, you know, with weird hair, or just normal dudes. There's everything all over the place. But you have to kind of go with it, whatever happens. So,
yeah, there's so many variables. I mean, you know, maybe you have to travel 2 hours. Maybe you have to travel 6 hours. Maybe you show up at 9 o'clock and compete at 4 o'clock. Maybe you, you know, show up at 10 o'clock and compete at 11 o'clock. There's just so many. It's just such a different rhythm than just normal training.
So you're a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt now, but you've competed quite a while, quite a lot at blue belt, purple belt, brown, all through the ranks. Can you talk a little bit about your approach to competing, like the day of, like how you deal with all that, like you said, the transportation aspect, the all the uncertainty around that. Like, how do you like to spend the several hours before the competition?
Well, I'll use the tournaments in New York as an example, like the IBJJF New York Open and the Nogi Pan Ams as examples. Those are probably my favorite tournaments of the year, and the problems that I would always have, like, just as far as, like, getting to the tournament, I don't have a driver's license, and I don't drive, so it's usually either I get a ride from somebody, or I take the Bolt bus, or the Chinatown bus, or whatever's available. And so my favorite way right now is to go up alone, take the Chinatown or the Bolt bus, get there, you know, grab a bagel or grab a coffee and ride my skateboard around a little bit, show up at the tournament, compete, and then go skateboard some more somewhere, you know, like skate through the city. And to me, that's the least stressful way to do it and the way that I enjoy doing it the most, because if I get a ride, for example, I get up in the morning, it's very early, I get in the car with somebody, I'm nervous, so I got to pee 8 million times, which means we have to hit almost every single rest stop on the way to New York,
yes,
which is like a 2.5 hour drive. It's irritating for them, I'm sure. It's irritating for me.
Do you like to talk to people before you're competing?
Like, not really. I mean, it depends on the mood I'm in, but like when I'm driving up to a tournament, I don't like talking to people.
Yeah.
When I get to the tournament, I'll put on a hoodie and I put on my headphones and I'll either zone out for a little bit, or if I feel like I'm getting in my own head too much, then I'll find somebody to like joke around with.
Yeah.
And try and blow off some steam that way.
That's one of the challenging things I have with competing is, you know, you show up there, and there's a lot of people you know that you haven't seen in a long time, and they're friends. There's a close-knit jiu-jitsu community, right? So there's a lot of people that you haven't talked to in person in a long time, and there they are in person. So what you want to do is kind of hide away and just get ready for competition, like get your, you know, relax, like you said, just chill out. But there's all these people that you kind of run into that you have to have a conversation with, and
yeah.
It's a funny balance that you have to strike, because I want to be in a place where, like, I don't care about talking to people, that I would just enjoy, you know, having a conversation with a lot of old friends, recent friends, like Facebook friends. There's people I haven't, like, met except on Facebook. They'll come up in competition and be like, hey, aren't you that dude?
Aren't you that dude from that famous podcast?
Yeah, from that podcast, yeah. You're actually thinking of competing in Nogi Pans this time around, right?
Yeah, that's, I mean, I signed up last week.
Yeah, that's awesome. So this is your first, I believe your first tournament as a black belt, right?
Yep.
What do you think is the difference between competing as a black belt and competing at the other ranks? Because black belt is sort of the ultimate. There's guys that have been doing it for, you know, 20, 30 years at black belt that you have to go against. So there's potentially so much experience there.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting belt because you have guys that have been, well, men and women who've been competing at black belt for, you know, 10 years. I mean, you have people like Salo Ribeiro, who does Masters Division sometimes, I think, and Senior 1 sometimes, maybe Senior 2. And then you have, you know, I mean, or you have somebody like Shanji Ribeiro, who's still doing adult divisions, but he's been competing in adult divisions for 10 years now. And then you have him side by side with somebody like AJ Agazarm,
right,
who's a very new black belt, but he's already very dominant on the black belt scene.
Yes.
So, you know, it's an interesting question because, like, for example, AJ Agazarm just had a match with Eduardo Tellis.
Yeah.
And, you know, Tellis has been around for a long time in the black belt divisions, and Agazarm hasn't been around for a long time. And I think he beat Tellis.
Yes, he did, yeah.
And it's pretty, I think it's, that's what makes the black belt division so cool, is that, you know, you have like, you know, younger guys that are like hungry black belts that want to, you know, that are mentally confident, physically prepared, and, you know, just ready to face anybody who gets on the mat. They don't care if the person's been a black belt for 10, 15 years. They're still going to compete. They're still game, you know?
I mean, Tellis is a really good example because he was ahead of a major team, you know? So do you think there's more pressure when you're a black belt, especially like you're an instructor as well? There's a lot, not to put pressure on you, but there's a lot of students that look up to you, you know, that, you know, follow you. You know, there's that one fan from Kentucky that's a big fan of yours, mistakenly, because he originally thought you were into bodybuilding. But I mean,
that guy.
Yes, that guy. Sorry, there's a reference into two podcasts back. But is there more pressure, do you think, as a black belt instructor, when you step on the mat?
I mean, I think it depends on the person. Like, the people at Balance are very good about not putting their expectations on me, I think. Yeah. Which I appreciate because, you know, A, I'm not really an active competitor. I'm just a guy that jumps in every once in a while. And, you know, and like my instructors, Phil and Rick, are supportive. Like, they don't really care about the result. They just want to make sure that I'm prepared and, you know, I get the most out of it that I can. And, you know, I think my teammates and my training partners make it, you know, very easy for me to be comfortable competing. I mean, there's, you know, there's some people who put a little bit of pressure and have unrealistic expectations. But the way I look at it is that competition is very different than, it's a different measuring stick for your jiu-jitsu than teaching or rolling on the mats. Like, to be a good competitor, you have to be able to handle, you know, the social stresses that we talked about.
Right.
You have to be able to, you know, it's a whole separate thing. So I think that the people that I, whose opinions I care about, all know that whether, you know, they'll still respect my jiu-jitsu and they'll still respect me whether I win or lose. So right. I feel very little pressure.
I mean, you say that, and I feel like a part of it is you might have been conditioned to say that. I mean, at least for me, like, I also say the same thing, right? But I can't help but be influenced by, you know, for example, you know, I'm also competing in no-gi pants, and I'll be up at like 11 a.m., but I'll spend the rest of the day there. So after I'm done at like 12, I'll have to answer maybe 20 to 30 times to friends of how well I did.
Or yeah, like, how'd you do?
There is some social pressure because for some reason I do feel that it's difficult to to answer that question when I lose. It's hard to say, you know, you know, why is it hard to explain that you lost versus that you won? Because it's, you know, competition technically, it's a very personal experience and it's all about you. It's about learning. You know, you give everything you can to win, but if it doesn't work, then, you know, you don't, and you deal with that. But, you know, people don't care about the details of that. They don't care how good of an experience you had. They just kind of want to know, hey, did you win or did you lose?
Yeah. I think the thing that takes a lot of pressure off, though, is having like a long-term view of it. Like I've been in situations before competing where, you know, I felt a lot of pressure to do well because people expected it of me and they were putting their expectations on me. And then if I didn't perform, they would say like stupid shit to me. Like, oh, I can't believe you lost. Like stuff like, you know, that makes it, like the kind of things that are really hard to hear after you lose.
Yeah.
What I found is that, you know, yeah, it sucks when you hear that. Like, you know, you come back to the class on Monday and everybody asks you how you did. And if you didn't do well, then, you know, some people give you disappointed looks. And then other people are very supportive and they're like, ah, you know what, you'll do fine next time. But I think the thing that helps is that no matter what people's reaction is, after a week or two, nobody remembers either way.
Yeah, nobody. Yes. So that's beautifully said because that's so true that you have to remember that the people, like you said, the people that matter won't care. And those are the people that will remember and they'll chat with you about your experience months down the line. But the people that are like all celebrate the fact that you won, they'll forget everything a week from now.
Yeah.
So it's it really you know, like,
all you got to do is be able to make it through that first week and you're fine.
So you have to answer. So you have to almost drill this, right? You have to answer, how did you do? I'm actually constantly trying to perfect my answering technique in terms of, you know, it's easy when you win. If you win every match, it's like, you know, I got first. That's my answer. But if you didn't win every match, you know, what is the most, the shortest, most poetic way of phrasing the fact that you got your ass kicked at some point, or you fucked up or something?
I think t-shirts are probably the best way. You got to have four t-shirts made. You have first place t-shirt, second place t-shirt, third place t-shirt, and then don't ask.
Oh, and then you would just wear them and just point.
Yep,
just point
exactly
to the shirt. This is a good idea. I like it. I think IBJJF should actually give you that shirt.
Yeah.
So you don't have to, and we would
instead
all
of the medal.
Yeah. One of the things I like about tournaments, especially IBJJF, is you get a pretty cool shirt when you go. And it's usually associated with the city, too, so you get to wear it. And I wear them proudly because it's like, I love the fact that I was there. You know, I stepped up to it, especially in tournaments. Like, you know, I had a lot of other stuff going on, and it was a pain in the ass, and I have like a million excuses not to go, but I go anyway. It just feels good. Yeah. Like you and I went to Worlds.
That was a fun trip.
Yeah, that was awesome. And, you know, and yeah, I still have a shirt from that, so that's cool.
Well, see, that's an interesting thing. Like, you asked me earlier about the stress of going to a tournament, and I think that was one of the, like, when I travel for tournaments, especially, like, you and Sean were my main companions for that trip.
Yes.
And having, like, being with you guys there was fantastic, because you guys are both low-key. You know, you're not like, yeah. You're not, neither of you guys are like, you know, are trying to be like, oh, you're going to win this, bro. You got this, bro. You got this.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you guys are just like you and I spent like 2 hours eating frozen shrimp in a parking lot at a supermarket. Like,
yeah.
You know, Sean drove me to the airport the last day, and we just kind of hung out and like, you know, talked a little bit on the drive there. Like, just real like mellow, peaceful.
Yeah.
If you can be around people like that for a tournament, at least for me, I think that's the ideal experience. And then going away for a tournament is great, because there's a lot less people that, you know, like the Worlds, we didn't really have to stop every 3 seconds and talk to somebody that we knew.
Right, you know? Exactly. You can just be, melt into the crowd.
Yeah. I like talking to people, though. I mean, I like running into some of the same old faces at tournaments, like, and saying hi. It's just, it's hard to have the same conversation 30 times in a row before your matches.
Yeah, that's true. And I have that trouble if I have friends that want to go watch me compete, like family or girlfriend. It's kind of like that to me is those are some of the hardest days, because I have to keep up conversation for hours because they're sitting there bored, and your mind enters it before competition, this kind of weird state. You're obviously nervous and on edge. And so it becomes difficult to enjoy conversation with people that you usually do enjoy talking to.
Yeah, I think that's my problem too. Like, not a problem really, but it's an interesting dilemma for me. Because now, you know, my wife Angela trains, and for this tournament that's coming up, the Nogi Pan tournament, you know, we were discussing whether or not, you know, she was going to come up with me to support me during the tournament. And, you know, I think I'm going to go up alone this time. And she understands, because, you know, for me, there's a couple factors involved. Like, you know, A, I would feel like I really like being around her. Of course, she's my wife, you know, but like, I don't want to, well, A, I don't want her to be bored.
Yeah.
And also too, I don't want to like, I think part of me, like, it's silly, but I would worry about losing in front of her. And I know it sounds kind of stupid, but, like, it would just be kind of, that's, like, something on my mind that I don't really need on my mind before I compete.
Yeah.
Like, if I would lose a match and, you know, let's say, like, I lose and I feel, like, shit about myself, and then, you know, I don't know, like, she wouldn't care. I mean, she's super supportive, and she'd be happy for me either way, but in my own head, I think that would bother me a little bit. So I think better just to, you know, follow the formula that I've always followed and just go up alone.
And I think if she decides to actually compete herself at some point, I don't know if she's interested in that, but that would be a fun experience to where you both go and compete. I think that would be...
See, that would be different. I would really like that. Like, if she and I competed together at a tournament, and I'm sure that'll happen in the future. And then she said that she wants me to coach her when she competes. So, I mean, that'll happen at some point. I think it would just be different if she was like a spectator and watching. I would feel kind of funny, you know?
Yeah. I've spoken with a few black belts actually recently at Balance, and we have a lot of black belts, as you know. And like one of them who used to compete a lot, I think, is James. But he hasn't competed recently, right? For a few years.
It's been a while.
Yeah, he's been thinking about jumping back in. And, like, I'm kind of borderline, like, recreational player, too. So it's kind of an interesting challenge to be of how to approach competing when you're just a recreational player. Like, you train a lot, you know, you might train even every day, but you're not, like, you know, doing all the right cardio stuff that the people that are winning the divisions are doing.
Yeah, and it's, I think, a good thing for you, though. I don't know how you view this, but something that I think is maybe helpful, might be helpful for you mentally, is that I imagine you probably don't feel like a ton of stress because jiu-jitsu is not your livelihood.
Right.
Like, you can do jiu-jitsu, you can compete, and then, you know, I mean, you always do well. You're an excellent competitor. But if you didn't do well, it's not like it's staring you right in the face all day, every day, you know?
Yeah, but it's that's true. So one of the challenges, though, you know, I was thinking about this, and there's always a source of stress, no matter where you are, no matter how, if you're an instructor, if you're a white belt, it doesn't seem to matter. Like for me right now as a purple belt, the stress is in the fact that, like, I have a certain pressure of showing that my technique is you know, I deserve to have a purple belt. You know, yeah. What I mean? I, like, what I'm afraid of is not so much losing, it's losing badly. And I think a lot of people are, like, a lot of times I'm defensive in a way that I shouldn't be, like, overly defensive, where I just don't want this person to, you know, just make me look terrible, like, submit me easily in the first, you know, 10 seconds or something. And what, yeah. That kind of mental state produces the kind of jiu-jitsu that I don't enjoy doing. it's like it's a very safe jiu-jitsu where I feel like I'm not even like really playing. I'm almost like focused on like winning too much, you know, winning 2-0.
Yeah.
So there's this kind of this challenging, stressful situation where I really don't want to lose, but at the same time, I also don't want to win by 2 points. And especially, you know, that comes from being videotaped. Like, for example, the AGL and PGL tournaments, you know, these local tournaments, they videotape everything. And they have, like, commentary and stuff, right? And they put up the videos. So I know whatever I do will be on video, online.
Yeah, and somebody's going to be commentating on it.
And I know it sounds silly because I can't quite figure out, like, how I can embarrass myself. But there's a certain fear of just like,
just wear that rash guard.
Yeah, the silly ass with like dragons and whatever yeah. I feel like I would enjoy competing a lot more if nobody would know how I did.
That's like that Boss Rutten thing.
Yeah.
You know, his ideal way of fighting in a competition would be just to go into a room alone with some. Actually, we talked about this in the last podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Right? I think so. A couple back, yeah.
Yeah, just going alone in a room with somebody and just you and that person, you compete, and then nobody else knows what happened.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to, you know, obviously you can't create that situation, but you can do it mentally. I think, so what do you think about announcing the fact that you're competing and announcing results of your competition on Facebook?
I mean, I don't, like, for me, I'm pretty low-key about those sort of things. So, I mean, obviously, I'm discussing a tournament that I'm doing in a week and a half on a podcast with hundreds of millions of listeners. So I think the world's going to know. But generally, like, the less people that know, the better. Like, I tell almost nobody when I'm competing,
yeah,
unless I have to. And then afterwards, I usually almost never mention the result.
Right. Do you think this will actually be just the very fact that you're talking about it? It's actually a little bit less than hundreds of millions, but still a couple of people might still know that you're competing. Do you think they'll add actually more stress?
Nah, you know, there's a strange thing going on with this tournament where I feel I have this like mental thing going in my head right now where the only part of the tournament that actually matters is the minutes after I step on the mat and slap hands with my opponent.
Yes.
And everything else, like, I honestly, for the first time in any tournament that I've done, I feel like that's the only part that matters and that nothing else is really, I'm not even really thinking about it outside of, like, I'm just training as hard as I possibly can and focusing on my game. And I feel, my training feels excellent right now. I feel in the next week or two, I'm going to be in, you know, my conditioning feels good and I feel my training is going to get better in the next week or two. And so I feel like all I really have to think about is just the second I get on the mat and slap hands and then the 6 minutes after that and then, you know, that's all I really have to worry about. So for some reason, I'm not nervous about this. I don't feel stressed. I don't really care who knows about it, you know, just as long as people don't make a big deal out of it, like, beforehand.
Yes. That, like, for example, Ronnie Wiest, does something that, you know, usually scares the shit out of me, which is, you know, right before his matches or whatever, he'll post the fact that he's competing, and he'll also post an ultra confident message about how well he's going to do that day.
Yeah.
And that's great, you know, and he loves it. He's definitely an inspiration to me because he loves competing so much. He doesn't have any kind of hesitation about, you know, should I compete or not? He just kind of jumps in everywhere. But he posts that stuff on Facebook with, like, you know, he has a lot of people that look up to him as well. And that doesn't seem to affect him. That doesn't bring the extra stress of, like, hey, all these people are counting on me to win. He just kind of is like, fuck it.
I really respect that about him. Yeah. Like, that he is so open about his competition on Facebook, and I mean, I admire that he competes a lot too. But the thing that I really have a lot of respect for about Ronnie is that he is somebody, you know, you and him both compete, you know, more than most people do laundry. And neither of you guys have an attitude where you expect everybody to compete to earn your respect. Like,
oh, yeah.
Like, I don't, like, Ronnie, you know, he knows that some people aren't competitors, and that's okay. And so, like, and I think you're the same way. Like, yes. You guys compete a lot, and you enjoy it for yourselves, but you don't, you know that that's not for everybody.
Absolutely. I think of competing as actually a pretty silly thing. Like, it's just like, it's almost like an addiction for me, you know, and for a lot of competitors as well. It's like another video game. Ultimately, a lot of us are, you know, everybody that does jiu-jitsu competes. They do usually so on the mat. They, you know, like when they train, they compete against themselves or against, like, there's usually somebody else that they started with that they're constantly kind of going head-to-head with. So you compete against yourself. You're constantly trying to improve. And that's the same. In many ways, going out to compete like no-gi pants is just a stupid idea because you're doing the same thing you do every day anyway, but you have to now pay money and you have to travel several hours there and back and you have to waste a day. And so it's just this extra thing. But
it's funny because, like, a lot of people talk about competition as the only way to really test yourself. Like, they say, oh, well, how do you know if your jiu-jitsu is really going to work against somebody unless you compete in a jiu-jitsu tournament? And I think it's a good challenge in that way. And I think that's, you know, it's definitely different trying to apply your jiu-jitsu in a tournament than it is on your own home mats. But I think a really undervalued, I think an alternative to that, if you don't want to compete, that will benefit you almost as much as competing, is visiting other schools.
Yes.
Because when you visit other schools, you know, a lot of the time, I mean, I know I've been to other schools, and there's times where I feel like I'm in a competition where there's a target on my back. Everybody's going hard with me. They want to show the new guy, you know, the visitor, like, we're a tough school. We train hard here.
Yes.
But I get to have multiple matches. Even if I get tapped in my first match, I can still train with four or five people afterwards.
Yes.
I get to compete outside of my experience level. Like, when I was a purple belt, I could go visit Enzo school and roll with the brown belt and a black belt.
Yes.
You know, and I mean, I could go to Marcelo school. I went to Marcelo Garcia school and rolled with Marcelo Garcia, and that dude beat the shit out of me.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the only time in my life I would, you know, even in tournaments, I would never have the chance to compete against him, you know?
Yeah. And it's funny because, because we're both on the East Coast, Marcelo school's on the East Coast, and we're balances on the East Coast. I oftentimes, his guys are the ones I end up, you know, competing against in the because he produces. He's a relatively young school, but he has a lot of really tough guys coming up through the ranks. So yeah. I get to compete against them. And when I've visited his school, I haven't once rolled against those guys I'm competing. We always kind of eye each other and. And we don't get to, when in reality, I could have just rolled with them and that'd be the competition. I don't need to go to a tournament. I just go hard with them because his guys actually do go, you know, one of the principles that I think Marcelo lives by is that if you're looking to be a competitor, that you should roll often at the pace that you would be competing at. You need to be rolling hard.
Yeah, I mean, like when I went to his school a couple years ago, you know, when I rolled with him, I was going light because I didn't really know, like, you know, there's that weird moment where you don't know how hard you're supposed to go
yes.
with somebody.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, go hard, man, go hard. And, you know, I mean, I tried. It didn't work out for me, but, like, I thought it was really cool that, you know, I mean, I thought it was awesome that he even, you know, rolled with me and my brother and, you know, the people that we were with. But I thought it was cool, too, that he was like, nah, go as hard as you want. Just, you know. Bring it to me. Bring it.
Yeah, it was still probably pretty hard to go hard against him.
Oh, I couldn't, because you go hard against a guy like that, you're going to get caught even quicker.
Yeah. And so, because we try to talk about at least one badass dude, one guy I wanted to mention is one of the legends on the competition scene is nicknamed Megaton, Wellington Diaz. I think
that's
he's
awesome.
Yeah, everybody loves him. He's in his late 40s now, I believe. And has famously competed in every single Worlds, IBJJF, Mondiales.
Which by default is always the adult division.
Always the adult division. So
there's no other, there's no Masters, there's no Senior One, you know? Like, it's kind of cool that the guy is 40 years old and he's competed in every single Worlds against, you know, 21-year-old black belt killers.
Yeah, and not just Worlds. So I believe he competes in adult divisions in every single tournament he enters. So he actually got a bronze medal in the 2010 Europeans in the adult division. So I mean, nice. he does against these young guys. He does pretty well, and he does. So he does like the featherweight division, which is a really tough division.
Rafa Mendez, yeah. And Cobrinha.
And so it's very technical, aggressive guys. He got his black belt at 18, so 30 years ago.
Wow.
From Hoyler. Yeah, and, you know, it's part, and he hasn't stopped competing since then. It's a very inspiring example of the fact that jiu-jitsu can be done at a high competitive level. Into old age.
Yeah, and he, you know, I mean, he doesn't medal anymore at like the Worlds or the Pans or anything, but he gives a lot of those guys a run for their money.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not like, you know, he doesn't just get out there and get tapped in like 2 seconds. Like, he, you know, he puts up a fight and he has some great matches with some great competitors.
Yeah.
That are like decades younger than him.
Can you see yourself doing the same thing? Do you see yourself competing when you're like 50 as a black belt? I mean, I imagine you're going to be, I mean, you love being a teacher, you're an instructor, and I imagine you might continue being an instructor for a long time. So do you see yourself competing in 20 years from now?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you know, it's the kind of thing where with competition, I have no goals.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, I could see myself probably just jumping into tournaments every now and again for, you know, the next 20 years or so, just to see what happens, you know? I've tried to force myself to be a person who, you know, like you read those, like, self-help books that are like, you know, sports psychology, like, okay, set goals and have a plan and believe in yourself and every morning recite your positive affirmations, and you know, and I respect that stuff, and I think it takes a certain personality type to follow that path, and that's my path is different. Like, I set sort of goals for myself, but it's like that what we were talking about with the anti-fragile. Mm-hmm. Like, I try and have like a sort of a heuristic, like a rule of thumb idea of what I'm going for, but I don't set like a specific, you know, on Tuesday I'm going to do strength and conditioning for 48 minutes. And then I'm going to, you know, like, so as far as competing for the next 20 years, I'm more of like the kind of person that is likely to randomly jump into a tournament without thinking about it every once in a while.
Do you go through periods of, I know I do, of like where you're all about competing, and then like the next month you could see yourself never competing again, and then again next month you're like all about competing again?
Yeah.
Do you go through...
Like right after the last term I did was the Worlds that you and I were at in 2012.
Yes.
And for like a month after that, you know, in my head I was like, all right, that was so much fun. I'm gonna jump into every tournament that I find. And,
yeah.
You know, and then I didn't. And then the next month I was like, fuck tournaments. I don't want to do that. You know?
Yeah. It's an interesting sort of contradiction that we live in terms of all these kind of different styles of goals. So I love learning, and a lot of times learning in jiu-jitsu is counter to competing, because, you know, in 2 weeks we're doing no-gi pans, and you know, I remember like one of our black belts showed a cool technique, and I had to stop my brain from like being interested in that technique because I wanted to still focus on just sharpening the game that I've been working on.
Oh, I got you.
As opposed to exploring.
That's what makes it hard, is that, I mean, I think that, I don't know if you feel this way, like, it sounds like you do, but I think jiu-jitsu is just so, it's so interesting on its own.
Yes.
Like, it's so much fun, and it's so fascinating, and so, it's so engaging and satisfying just going into the gym and training, you know, every day, that I feel like I like competing every once in a while, but I feel like I'm okay without it, too. Like, I'm satisfied enough, you know? Like, yeah. I don't need fries with that burger.
Yeah, at the same time, like, those fries, what I remember every time, I try to remind myself, is how much competition affects me psychologically for months after in a positive way, in the sense that everything I fuck up on in competition, I remember. For some reason, it really sticks in my head, and I try to fix that part of my game when I train. So it kind of really focuses, like nothing else does. You know, you can pass my guard over and over the same way in training, but nothing drives me to stop that more than if you do it once in competition.
Yeah, you're right about that. That's the kind of stuff that'll keep you up at night from sleeping.
Yeah, you wake up doing jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. What do you think about Wellington Megaton competing as an adult versus competing as a in his age division? Do you think there's like, what would you recommend somebody, like, for example, I just turned 30. Your brother is turning 30, Drew, at the end of the year. So you get to be able to do masters, and there's guys that are interested in competing in their 40s. Do you recommend you know, a lot of times the older divisions can be very challenging as well. It's very high-level guys there.
I think it depends. I mean, like, for me, like, I've gotten a couple of, in the past, like, when I did the no-gi Pan Ams in 2011, I did the Masters division at Brown Belt, and then I did the adult division the following year at Brown Belt. But when I did the Masters division, it was the first Masters division I ever did. It was the only one I've done, but, you know, I got a couple of, like, comments from people, like, sort of bullshit comments, like, are you doing the old man's division, blah blah blah, like, yeah. Almost like I didn't have a right to do it,
right?
And I think what works against my favor is that I look like I'm like 23 or 24. Like, I look pretty yeah. young for my age.
Yes.
I'm 34, but everybody thinks that I'm young. But as far as, like, you know, like, what people don't realize is that everybody feels different when they wake up in the morning. Yes. Like, you know, some people think, like, oh, you know, Masters division is only if you're, you know, you don't own a school and you're a part-time jiu-jitsu guy and you got eight kids and work three jobs, then do the Masters division, but otherwise do adult. I think that's bullshit. I think, you know, if you wake up and you feel like you want to compete against other people that are your age and are probably waking up feeling the same way you feel when you wake up in the morning,
yeah,
then do that. You know, like, I mean, I'm 34. I look like a 24-year-old Greek god, but I'm just kidding. But, you know, I look young for my age, but I, you know, I mean, Sometimes I feel like I'm 50 when I get up. Right. You know, I've been skateboarding for 25 years. My knees feel like shit sometimes.
And it's also your mentally, like when I go against, you know, there's a bunch of competitors, especially at the earlier ranks of like blue and purple belt, that are like 18, 19 years old. And while like physically I don't care about the difference between them and me, but mentally they just approach competing and training a lot differently. And so I just sometimes don't actually enjoy going against some of those younger guys, not just technique wise, but just because they're there for a different reason.
Yeah.
Like the amount of aggression that they show, like I feel like in some of those matches, I don't get to learn as much. You know, I can still win the match, but I have to win it by being like a meathead. And I don't enjoy it. I like it when matches go technical. And it seems to me that the older guys, and by older, I mean actually late 20s even, they start becoming more technical. They start, like, using their head more.
And I think a lot of those guys have a more mature attitude towards competition as well. Like, I feel like sometimes with younger competitors in any sport, it could be, you know, in my involvement in the squash community, I see it a lot. you know, like 20-year-olds tend to look at it as like, if I beat you, then I've defeated you as a man.
Yes.
You know, whereas like a 30-year-old or 35, and this is not, you know, everybody, of course, but like the guys that I've rolled, when I roll with somebody who's 35 and when I've competed against people that are like 30, 35, you know, like, we both get on the mat and we slap hands and we roll for 6 minutes or whatever. And then we're done. And it's not like, you know, like we just had a good roll. Good job, dude. You know, like, it's not like, there's not that as much ego involved, I feel like, because they don't need to prove anything. If you're a 35-year-old, you know, person, you're a grown up. You don't have to prove anything to anybody.
Yeah, and it's a slightly different experience. It's a little bit more positive in some sense. But, of course, like you said, everybody, we shouldn't generalize too much. But speaking of which, you did mention the squash community that has been, you know, hurt this week when the IOC announced that wrestling has won over squash and baseball and softball for the 2020 Olympics.
I did actually make sure to congratulate our friend Charlie Neely.
Yes.
On behalf of the squash community,
we have
a hearty congratulations.
But I should say that you're joking, of course, because I'm pretty sure neither you or I still know what squash is.
I did congratulate him from the squash community.
Oh, you did?
But I don't know much about squash.
Yeah. But it was good to hear that, you know, we're both actually fans of wrestling in a sense that we like to apply wrestling and grappling. So we're like, I should say, not fans of wrestling, but students of wrestling. So it's pretty cool that we get to see the fact that wrestling stays in the 2020 Olympics means we'll probably get to see more YouTube videos of wrestling that we can study and learn from.
Yeah, and one thing actually I wanted to point out about, like with the wrestling stuff that we were talking about last time, and then, you know, like other comments that I make sometimes on the podcast, like, for example, last time on wrestling, when we were talking about wrestling, like, I was talking about squash and, like, trying to play the devil's advocate for the side of squash and, you know, making points about that. I don't always know what I'm talking about. Like, I'm pretty, like, I have this habit of, like on this podcast, I have a sort of an idea of what I'm going to talk about, but generally I let my gums flap.
Yep.
And whatever comes out is, it's not always accurate and it's not always like a perfect representation of what I really believe.
Right.
I think my friends know that about me because I say some crazy shit sometimes. It doesn't make any sense. And people just kind of smile uncomfortably and, you know, let it fly. But what I want to point out to people is like with, you know, I love wrestling just like, you know, just like any other grappler does. And I think it's awesome that wrestling got into the Olympics. My whole point was last week was just that, deserves, in my opinion, to be there because it's one of the most historical sports in the Olympics. And same thing, there was another thing that, that I said last week that was kind of stupid too about how, you know, I wouldn't show any of my friends, any jiu-jitsu matches because they're all boring. That's not strictly true either. I mean, there's like Marcelo matches, Jacare matches that I would, you know, show somebody. But you guys have to admit that there are a lot of boring jiu-jitsu matches out there.
Yeah, but there's something you said which is very true. I mean, you're kind of defending what you said, but like something we forget is I also have friends that giggle at the fact that there's two guys like hugging each other.
Sure.
Like it's not even just about the sport is boring. It's the fact that, you know, and I had this in high school when I wrestled. You wear the silliest outfit. You're wearing like a loincloth. And, and there's always going to be people that just kind of giggle at that. Although the UFC is slowly changing that. People are a little bit more used to the two shirtless guys hugging each other kind of thing. But
true.
But yeah, you know, I don't think you have to give out that warning that I find that I do the same thing. I'll stick to my guns on an argument that I completely don't believe in just because I started saying something.
Yeah.
I'll stubbornly defend it to the death, but
I mean, even though I say some stupid stuff sometimes, like I think that, you know, in a way it's like last time with, you, me and Tim, like, you know, if everybody agrees all the time and, you know, we're all sitting there going, oh, yeah, dude, you're right. Yeah, you're right, dude, yeah. Then it's going to be a boring podcast. So, you know, hopefully my stupidity makes this more interesting for you guys.
Yeah. Yeah, you're keeping it all anti-fragile.
Exactly.
Hey, so because I don't want my ass to get kicked by your wife, Angie... I have to mention her on this podcast because we failed to mention her last time.
Yeah, she actually left the house earlier today, and she said, don't forget to mention me on the podcast. So,
well, I'm not sure exactly what we need to mention, but we should say that she's awesome.
She's quite good.
I mean, we might as well mention the fact that that you should definitely visit Sweet Etc. Cake Shop on Facebook. And
yep,
like it.
Sweet Etc. Shop, yeah.
Awesome. I'll put a link up.
For the finest in culinary delights.
The finest. Yeah.
But actually, we talked about having her on sometime soon, which would be kind of cool. Not because she's my wife, but because she's actually she's like a high-level pastry chef. And she is also involved in jiu-jitsu, and she's smart enough to know interesting ways to draw correlations between the two, which is kind of a subject that you and I talked about, like trying to find guests on this podcast that are actually like normal people that have good insight into, you know, into other things besides jiu-jitsu, and then know how to, like, you know, maybe having somebody like, you know, a mutual friend of ours who was a chess champion in another country talk about his experiences with jiu-jitsu and chess.
Yes.
Or Angie with her experiences with pastry and jiu-jitsu.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Yeah, it's there's actually a lot of the culinary industry with it's also often dominated by guys, and it's a hard-nosed world. So
yeah,
you have to. So I know exactly where she got her awesome guard passing from.
Yeah, it's yeah, she didn't get it from me. She got it from the culinary world.
Exactly. There you have it, folks. If you want to do any cross training, I would suggest trying to bake a cake.
Yep.
All right, man. Thanks for talking. This is our first time of doing it on Skype. You know, the world of technology is wonderful. Hopefully it sounds all right.
If it doesn't sound all right, it's most likely my fault because I'm using an 8-year-old laptop.
Yeah, with iPhone headphones, and I'm using a headset.
We're using two Dixie cups and a string.
Yeah, and it's embarrassing because we live close together. We have no reason to be using Skype. We can just talk in person, but...
I know, it's not like you're on, like, some, like, space station 200 miles above, you know.
Yeah, and we're just lazy asses on a weekend that didn't want to get out of the house.
True.
Well, thanks for talking to me, man.
Thanks, Lex. Stay classy, Philadelphia.